皆様お待たせ。
Thank you for waiting, ladies and gentlemen. We will now start the afternoon session. We're going to start the discussions in panel 3. The theme is U.S.-Japan relations. I'm going to introduce the speakers and the moderator. To your left, we have the moderator, Mr. Tsuyoshi Sunohara, Senior Staff Writer of Nikkei and Director of Office of Global Studies at the Japan Center for Economic Research. Then I introduce the panelists. Former Ambassador of Japan to the United States, Mr. Ichiro Fujisaki. Next, Professor of the University of Hong Kong, Dr. Richard Hu. Senior Vice Minister of Defense, Mr. Akihisa Nagashima. Senior Fellow of the Brookings Institution, Dr. Jeffrey Bader. I now ask Mr. Sunohara to moderate the session. Thank you, and good afternoon. Thank you very much for coming, despite your busy schedules. So this is panel 3, and the title, as is shown on the program, is U.S.-Japan Relations, U.S.-Japan Alliance. It's one of the hottest topics of the day. The panelists gathered here today, I think, are well known. Mr. Fujisaki was ambassador in Washington until very recently. He's just returned back from the U.S. with the hot information and the Japan-U.S. relations. And we have Dr. Hu from Hong Kong. So after the change in leadership, what is the Chinese view on security and Japan-U.S. relations? I look forward to his view. Now, Mr. Nagashima, I know your party is having a difficult time with the elections, and I'm sure that you want to be standing in front of the Tachikawa Station, your constituency, but I'm very grateful that you decided to join us today. And Dr. Jeffrey Bader, until very recently, he was at the White House in the Obama administration overseeing the Asian policy, senior director for East Asian Affairs. And he was one of the members of the foreign policy advisors to Mr. Obama's campaign. So he still has great influence on Asia policy of the Obama administration. My great friend, Dr. Bader, thank you for coming. So that was the brief introduction, and so I'd like to ask each of the panelists to speak for about 10 minutes, talking about the current Japan-U.S. relations, the alliance, or the Northeast Asian situation. And so we'd like to have some exchange of views amongst the panelists, and then at the end, we'd like to take questions from the audience. So, Mr. Fujisaki, would you like to begin? Thank you. Thank you for the introduction. My name is Fujisaki. Actually, it's very regrettable today because in 48 hours, I'll be relieved of my duty. I'm still ambassador for the next 48 hours. Once I'm released from duty, immediately, I can say, Mr. Nagashima, you're completely wrong. You've got it upside down. But at this point of time, it's up to here, but I can't say it. So I don't think I can meet your expectations. I'm just joking, of course. I'm not going to be very blunt in 48 hours so suddenly. Now, I was ambassador for 4.5 years in the U.S., and Mr. Talbot, Dr. Bader, I had the opportunity to deal with you and because you were in government. And the 3 points I wanted to talk about. When I became the ambassador, I was quite concerned because it was the end of the Bush administration, and I was worried something might happen because at the end of the Clinton administration, as you know, concerning North Korean policy, there were some movements. And so I was concerned whether or not there might be such developments, and it actually happened. As you know, North Korea was moved off the terrorist nation list. Of course, there was a prior notification, but we did not necessarily come to an agreement about that treatment. Quite frankly, they did this TV show of some explosion, and in exchange, they removed North Korea from the list. So the policy had been overturned, and I don't think that that should ever happen again. So I said I'll talk about three points. I'm not going to just talk about the past. I want to draw some lessons. And I think that we should avoid that kind of shift at the end of the second Obama administration. So that's the lesson that we should learn. And the second point I want to talk about was the change in government in Japan. Two points about that. First, Okinawa issue. And the second, East Asian community issue. The Okinawa issue, I think you're very familiar with the history, so I won't go into the details. But in May, or rather, starting from 2009 and in May of 2010, it reverted to the original position. Now, East Asian community, in September 2010, Prime Minister Khan met with President Obama, and he said that he will not think about East Asian community without the U.S. So he removed that concern on the U.S. side with that comment. I don't know what the U.S. side felt. Dr. Beda knows better, so I should not comment about the U.S. response. But I think that the U.S.-Japan relations was... well, I don't think that the U.S.-Japan relation was overturned in that 1 or 2 years, but there might be one event or one change. Image of Japan had changed because Japan was seen to be very slow, but there was a detailed discussion amongst the bureaucrats and the politicians and with the counterparts in other countries. And once we made a decision, we didn't change so easily. So that was a reputation, but that reputation had been destroyed, I think. That's one thing that we can say. So it's not just about the Japan-U.S. relations, but the image of Japan has changed with the change in the government. Third point I wanted to make was about the tsunami and the earthquake. Well, we got help from all around the world, but the first to help and the greatest help was from the U.S. And when you're in Japan, well, we think about the Operation Tomodachi, but I was in Washington, and so I was in touch with the White House and the State Department and Defense Department, Energy Department people. I knew that they were working 24 hours a day worrying about something that was happening in another country. They were following the developments, and they rounded up all the nuclear scientists around the world. They set up a telephone network, had daily conferences, and I knew that that was going on in the U.S. side. So when I expressed my appreciation to the U.S., I want to raise the point that we were helped not by just people on the ground, but by the whole of the government of the U.S. Now, in Japan, there were people in the front line staking their lives, well, Japanese people. And what kind of appreciation have we shown these people on the front line? I think that we haven't fully appreciated their efforts. So I think that's one thing to think about. Now, thinking 5 to 8 years in the future, I was asked to give my view. One thing I can say is that Japan and U.S. Face common issues. There is this divided government, and that there is a huge fiscal issue. So those are two common issues. But the concerning the divided government, there is a fundamental difference between the two countries. In the U.S., there are three favorable conditions that Japan doesn't have. That the term of the president is 4 years, and the president has veto power, and the Congress, in the Congress, the party doesn't control the delegates. So although we have divided or government, the situation is quite different. So second point about the fiscal issue, people talk about the fiscal cliff. And I always say that it's not a fiscal cliff, it's a fiscal wall, because they built the wall themselves in the U.S. So the ruling and opposition party agreed to build this wall, so that if we don't agree, we're going to crash into the wall. So they intentionally set up that wall. Now, they have only 108% of debt versus GDP, but they've built the wall. We are over 200%, but we haven't built that wall. So I pay my respect to the U.S. Now, concerning U.S.-Japan cooperation going forward, in terms of security, there are various new issues emerging, cyber, space, etc. But I think at the root of all of our cooperation is the allocation of the Marines, the deployment of the Marine forces. On April 26th, there was the agreement this year. How are we going to implement that agreement? I think the ball is on the side of the U.S. Congress. I hope the U.S. government convinces the Congress so that the Marines will be moved to Guam and Hawaii from Okinawa. One more thing about Asia-Pacific. We need to establish international norms, and certainly for maritime issues, there is a political issue, but also there's the TPP issue on the economic side. I believe that Japan should accelerate its discussion about whether or not to participate in the TPP, but also U.S. should recognize that they can gain things through negotiation, that, and they should not try to score points before starting the negotiation. And in terms of international norms, democracy is the foundation, and human rights as well. And from that perspective, to be quite frank, if you look at the situation in Asia concerning the issue of Myanmar, Japan had led the way. U.S. had followed. I think that's the that's what happened. And what can Japan and U.S. do, and what should we be careful about going forward? I think rather than foreign policy, I mean, I'm a diplomat, so it's strange for me to be saying this, but I think we should focus on making Japan stronger. We need stable politics. It's a choice of the people. If they didn't enjoy good governments, we chose them, so we have to choose a good, strong government, the people, that is. And also we need to rebuild our economy. That's what needs to be done. And as Mr. Iwata said, there's the yen rate issue in terms of industrial structure. There's the pick-the-winner method in Asia, or there's the innovative economy in the U.S. We're trapped in between. So we need to rebuild our economy. And earlier there was the talk about the rightward shift, and in the U.S. I submitted some articles, but we're not shifting to the right. This issue we did not raise, and it's going to be resolved soon. That's what I've been saying. What's important for Japan, it's strange for me to be saying this, but it's not about removing the bureaucrats, but we need to come together, all Japan, all the players coming together to rebuild Japan. That's what's necessary. Now, what should be done in the U.S.? That's for the U.S. to decide, not for me to say. But various new situations are emerging. So you have the same administration, same set of policies, I think, but you will have different people. And I think there will be changes from the foreign policy side. So you have new administration in China. You can't leave Middle East alone. The Iran situation is evolving. And when the U.S. makes a move, what I expect is that don't move too quickly. Go slow. That's what I would like to ask the U.S. You are a huge elephant. And huge elephants should not run around, because if you do, the neighboring countries will have trouble keeping up. So please move slow. Now, all the leaders in Asia are changing, and so it's an opportunity. So we should consult together well between U.S. and Japan. And as I talked about Myanmar, I think we should go one step ahead of other countries, the two countries. And also we have commonalities between Japan and U.S. In addition to what I've already mentioned, we look at the doomsday scenario. We like to draw doomsday scenarios. The U.S. Has been talking about Japan as number one for the past 30 years. Many academics said that the era of the U.S. is over. And in Japan right now, people are very pessimistic, saying that our era is over. And on the cover of The Economist, we have Obama and Merkel wearing kimono and saying that we should not follow Japan. So people point to that article. But I think that is a very wrong image of Japan. I would assert that the international image of Japan is still very high. Our response to the earthquake was highly praised. And concerning Senkaku Islands, there are many views. But I'm very proud that nothing is happening in Japan. We should be respected that there is no incident in Japan over that. And so we should be proud of that. And the U.S. is the strongest country in the world. So we should not make self-fulfilling prophecies based on doomsday scenarios. I think that's important. Sorry, I'm jumping around, but that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Ambassador. Okay, now Dr. Hu, please.
Okay, thank you. It's my great pleasure to be in this excellent panel. Now, as I walk up to the patio, I notice I'm sitting between Mr. Fujisaki and also Mr. Nakashima. And also I'm sitting between United States and Japan. So my role here is to provide a Chinese voice. So the Chinese perspective of U.S.-Japanese relations. So because of the time limit, I will focus my remarks on three things. First, what is the Chinese perception of the evolving U.S.-Japan relations? And second, I like to put this Chinese perspective in a broader regional perspective or regional context to see how this relationship should be transformed and should be contribute to the future regional stabilities. And then last, I will make some comments about what kind of challenge or difficulty we need to expect down the road. Okay, about the Chinese perspective of U.S.-Japanese relations, I can give you a short answer and a long answer. The short answer is the official versions, and the longer answer is my interpretation of the official versions. Now, a lot of people ask the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman about how you comment on the recent development of U.S.-Japan alliance relationship development. And the standard answer from the Chinese Foreign Ministry is, I summarize in 2 points. First, U.S.-Japan alliance is a bilateral arrangement made under special historical conditions. It should not be go beyond the bilateral scope and should not undermine or infringing upon the interests of the third party. This is the first part of their answer. Now, second part of the official comments is Japan and the United States should respect regional countries' security concerns and make more contribution to regional peace and stability. So this is the short answer of the Chinese perspective of the U.S.-Japan alliance. Now, you have to read between lines what that means and what message is hidden in this statement. Now, my long answer is my interpretation. Now, to Chinese, U.S.-Japan alliance is a double-edged sword, because on one hand, this is the product of the post-war arrangement. So this is the historical product. After World War II, we have this special arrangement. Now, it is useful to constrain Japan's remilitarization. But on the other hand, although Chinese recognize the alliance's historical importance, but in recent years, especially since middle of 1990s, the Chinese view of this security relationship becoming more and more negative. I'll explain why. Now, I remember when I was a graduate student studying Europe, when we talk about the logic of NATO, there are three sentences summarized the logic of NATO, which is to keep the Germany down and keep American in and keep the Soviet out. Now, this is the logic of NATO. Now, if you apply this logic to U.S.-Japan alliance, during the Cold War, yes, the purpose is to keep Japan down, keep Japan from remilitarizing and return to military power, and also keep American in this region. Now, Soviet Union already gone, right? So what's the potential threat to this alliance? So obviously, the alliance since the end of Cold War has been transformed, and then there's a potential enemies here. So this makes the Chinese getting a little bit concerned about the future direction of this alliance. Now, when was the turning point, the Chinese view of the U.S.-Japan alliance becoming more negative? I think the turning point is 1995, 1996, when the Tokyo and Washington revised U.S.-Japan defense guidelines in 1995 and 1996, twice, during the Clinton administrations. Now, took place in the same time when there was a Taiwan crisis. So this is also remind Chinese the purpose of the revision of these defense guidelines. So to Chinese, since the middle 1990s, the alliance began to transform from the former Cold War security arrangement, which is an instrument to protect Japan against security threat, now to a new mechanism to cope with contingents on the Korean Peninsula and possibly in the Taiwan Strait. And then a larger picture issue is to balance the rising of China in East Asia. So that's, I think, more and more Chinese talking about the U.S.-Japan alliance in that sense. And I think the Chinese concern is understandable. Why? First, because over the last 20 years, not just since 9/11, 2001, even earlier, this gives Japan an excuse to pursue more assertive security policies and to normalize its military forces. This is something that makes China more concerned. And secondly, they concern about this because Washington began more willingly to engage or involve Japan in future regional scenarios like Taiwan Strait. And this is something really, make China very, very unhappy. And thirdly, look at the future drivers of this alliance relationship. And you see on both sides, there's a lot of talking about China factor or China threat. So China factor becoming the driving force for this relationship. Now, even worse, especially during the Bush administration, Bush, the junior administration, the Armitage report called for revision of the Japanese constitution and legitimizing the right of collective defense. So this is means if Japan moving toward that directions really change its laws, especially Article 9, moving toward the direction that more and more involved in the regional conflict, you know, outside East Asia, this is not a very good sign for China. So so that's the reason China getting more and more concerned about this relationship. Now, so China's concern about this relationship, there's reasons on both U.S. is pushing Japan to normalizing, becoming a normal state, and Japan used this opportunity to increase and to make more legal preparation for its future, you know, outside regions or even you know, go beyond the defense arrangement to involve the U.S. Contingent plan in these regions. So that brings me to the second point I want to talk about, which is if we put in a broader regional context to look at this, what kind of U.S.-Japan relationship will affect China's role in East Asia, and in what way China expect this relationship to change or to transform? I think if we put into the broader regional context to look at these issues, East Asian regional security becoming more, you know, not so optimistic, becoming actually more and more pessimistic pictures. There are several things in East Asia we need to address. First, the security dilemma things. And the IR scholars knows the security dilemma is very, very powerful force that drive international relations in this region. And second thing is underpinning the security dilemma is the very profound mistrust or even historical hatred, you know, in this region. And sometimes the mistrust is very intense, very profound to get rid of. So these are the realities in these regions. And then obviously another major variable in this region is the rise of China, how to deal with the newly rising, rapidly rising power of China in this region. So here comes the questions, in Chinese perspective, how this relationship should evolve, and especially look at Washington, what China expect Washington to do. As Ambassador Fujisaki just mentioned about United States is a huge elephant. A huge elephant should move slowly. But I would also want to add, huge elephant make any move should be cautiously and should be with prudence, not change its course too quickly. Now, one of the purpose of the U.S.-Japan Security Alliance is to reassure Japan, protect Japan's security from outside threat. Now, if U.S. want to play a positive role in this region, from Chinese perspective, U.S. should not just only assure Japan, but should also assure China as well. So U.S. have these roles, should be handle its relationship with Japan and China in a more balanced ways. Now, seeing from China, people see United States is have a very unbalanced approach to regional security issues. And this is not very healthy. And if U.S. want to see a stable regional security environment, it should it should provide equally good reassurance to the rising China and also Japan, because between these two countries, there's a lot of problem, historical problem, territorial disputes, and to let alone the security dilemma. So these two countries are trapped in a serious security dilemma. And Japan sees China as a rising power of China as a security threat. Japan's defense guidelines explicitly identify China as a security threat. A lot of people in China see the same way. So this is a very good telling about how these two countries see each other. Now, how to get beyond the trap of security dilemma? I think United States have a special role to play, especially Obama administration's want to carry out returning to Asian strategies, and how to play that game properly. I think U.S. should play the role how to dampen the security dilemma effect between Japan and China. Now, another thing I want to bring into the picture, which is for the future regional stabilities, I think regional institution building is very important. We see a new momentum to building regional security institution and economic community start after Asian financial crisis in the late 1990s. And this momentum, unfortunately, in recent year was interrupted. And because of the regional security problems and territorial disputes. And we see 10 years ago, ASEAN countries were on the driver's seat to push regional institution buildings. We see process like ASEAN plus 3 and then ASEAN plus 1 and also plus 3 process. We also see East Asian Summit in addition, on top of the APEC process. So we see many regional building initiative and project. Although these projects are overlapping, they have a conflict mandate, but this is a good sign for Asian countries to use their own way to manage security dilemma problems in this region. But unfortunately, this process was interrupted in recent years. So when U.S. return to Asia or pivot toward Asia, I think U.S. should play a proper role how to jumpstart this process. Without regional institution, how we can talk about regional stability, how we can manage problem between big powers like China and Japan. Especially China is on the rise, and it was perceived as a threat to many countries. So during the lunch talk, stroke talk about minilaterals, and I think minilaterals, in addition to the other regional security, other regional institution building process, is very useful. Here, I want to just propose one minilaterals we should pay special attention to, which is China, U.S., Japan trilateral dialogue. This idea was not new. Actually, had been exist for a long time. And but how we can use or restart this process as a confidence building measures to this region? Because now the three countries, especially the U.S. Japan leg was got after. In recent years, is consolidate, but the other two bilaterals all have problems. So we cannot just address one bilaterals. We need to address all three bilaterals. Without addressing all three bilaterals, we cannot solve the regional problems. So we need to use this trilateral dialogue, or whatever mechanism you call it, to build more trust among three countries. We need to have China accept U.S. have a legitimate role in East Asia, and accept Japan have a normalized role in regional affairs and broadly in international affairs, and also Japan and the U.S. should accept the rising China as a reality in these regions. So only use that kind of dialogue, I think we can reassure all three countries and then have a good a handle on the regional security problems. Now, let me close by saying my third point is about looking down the road, what is the major challenge? I think the major challenge now is not at international level, more in the domestic level. And we see there's a strong linkage between domestic politics and foreign policy, especially year 2012, this year. I heard Richard Bush said that this year was a year of tension, year of transition. And because we have leadership change, we have elections. So when leadership in a transition, if we have a territorial province, and no country, no national leader can back down. So this will drive the nationalism very high in all three countries, in all East Asian countries. So hopefully 2013 will be the year of opportunity for all East Asian countries, for both Japan and China, have the national leaders, new leaders, or new generation of leaders, have a good handle on their domestic agenda, and also play the leadership role to not let the nationalism on the driver's seat to influence their foreign policies. And we see China just finished the 18 parties Congress, have a new generation of leaders. We don't know the future leader, how they will, what kind of foreign policy agenda they will carry out. And in Japan, we are about to see the new leaders. And over last 5 or 6 years, we see too quick leadership successions. This is not good. And we see changes from outside. We see changes from Hatoyama's Asianist policy to NATO more idealic pacifist policy, and to now the current Prime Minister Noda's more realist policy. So we see these changes. And territorial disputes obviously is not very good for national leaders. But if we cannot have a good handle on our territorial disputes, it will feed each country's the rising of nationalism, and it will be the tragedy of security dilemma. It will becoming the self-fulfilling prophecies for national leaders. So I hope next year 2013 will be a year of opportunity, year of hope, and a year of cooperation for East Asian countries, especially for Japan, China, and the United States in this region. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Fu. The Noda, you call it realist regime, and Mr. Nagashima make a big nod. So now, Mr. Nagashima, please. Thank you very much for the invitation today. I'm here today not because I afford to do so, or I do not give up my election, but the Mr. Sunohara threatened me, and if I am absent, he will criticize in his editorial column. So I decided to join this symposium. And according to the Professor Fu, there are so many things I would like to actually counter, but I have a memo that I prepare, so I would like to the talk based on the memo. And we are the same classmate at SAIS, so we should be friendly today. So at the outset, I would like to make 3 points. And first point, since this is a very good opportunity, and Democratic the Party of Japan, the government, what is the development of Japan-U.S. Relations, and that's what I'd like to talk, although Ambassador Fujisaki talked about that. And then the Professor Fu talked about realist, and the Sonoda diplomacy that I'd like to talk about secondly. And thirdly, 5 years, 8 years from now, that's what is mentioned by Ambassador the Fujisaki, but in my case, 10 to 20 years ahead, about 2030, what will happen, that I'd like to talk about. Now, from Hatoyama to Kan to the Noda, the Mr. Beda, as well as the Ambassador Fujisaki were very much affected, but the first, the damage was very significant. The outside the prefecture and the inside Japan. And that was not necessarily remarks confined to the U.S. base. East Asia community, that particular concept, although there are many misunderstandings, the concern was shown by American side about the Prime Minister Hatoyama's the idea. Well, outside the prefecture of Okinawa and the inside, well, not the manifesto or the slogan of DPJ, but that is a personal the remarks made by Prime Minister Hatoyama during his election campaign. But East Asia community, from U.S. side, there was a concern expressed, and the foreign minister, then Foreign Minister Okada, U.S. would not be the part because in NAFTA, Japan is not member of NAFTA, and EU, Japan is not member. And so East Asia community, that is the composed by East Asian countries only. And so rather than his personal target, that becomes a target of the government, or defined as a target of the government, unfortunately. And the Japan, China, the Korea, the summit, shortly after the inauguration of the government was held at the end of September or in early October. And at the summit, the talks among the China, Korea, Japan, the Prime Minister Hatoyama said that Japan depended so too heavily on the United States. And therefore, slightly apart from the traditional Japan-U.S. relations, the shift, there will be some shift. So that kind of the remark was made by the Prime Minister Hatoyama. I had opportunity to discuss with Mr. Campbell, and he was very much concerned. And if the basis of the alliance is changed, rather than speaking to the other countries, should speak first to the United States. And so, his remarks only implies Japan should be more independent, but that he speaks too much, and also the Mr. Ozawa, the led 200 the Diet members, and they shake hands with Hu Jintao in China. So within a 2 to 3 months after the change of the government, that happened. And the refueling at the tank was withdrawn from the Indian Ocean, etc. So a series of events took place. And so although the change of the government was welcome, and however, traditional good relations formed with the LDP. And now, what is a new change under the DPJ? And so the U.S. was concerned, and then the series of those events, and therefore the first events damage the U.S.-Japan relations significantly. And I think that is one of the unfortunate developments. And under the Kan administration, as was mentioned by Ambassador Fujisaki, there was some the change of the course. And prior to the start of Noda administration, that I had a meeting to consider the foreign the policy for NODA. And East Asia community concept should be abandoned. And so we should set a new target. That's my advice to the Mr. NODA. And Mr. NODA accepted that advice. And I called it NODA doctrine. And nobody else called it the NODA doctrine. And Mr. Sunohara did not write on that. And NODA doctrine, to join the East Asia community, which is led by China, rather than that, we should expand our perspective. So Asia-Pacific should be the basis. So in Asia-Pacific region, the new order should be formed. And, of course, the much is discussed on the rise of China, and China tries to increase the power. But Japan-US should actually accept the change of the situation with a rule-based the scheme. And the rise of China is a reality, so we have to accept that as a reality. And, of course, we do not make the China the hostile enemy. And so, but when we consider East Asia, the most influential country is China. So vis-a-vis that influential country, that we should form the rule in advance. And if the rule is accepted by that the country, China, we can collaborate together. That is an order that we would like to create. And that is one pillar of the NODA doctrine. One pillar is the economy, and the other is the security, and third is the energy. And so based on those three pillars, we should reconstruct a Japan-US alliance. And the economy, as Mr. Fujisaki said, the TPP. And the final goal is FTAP. FTAP is FTA for Asia-Pacific. And that the APEC that is already decided. So in order to reach that goal, the realistic step is the TPP. And so I fully endorse the remarks of the ambassador. And so our manifesto, DBJ, if you read it, you do not know whether we are for or against the TPP, very vague. And I hate that kind of ambiguous expression that erodes the trust. But that we should be more bold to put force our endorsement about the TPP. And so high-level investment and the trade and economic rule, including intellectual property, and that is a very important pillar. And the second pillar is a security pillar. And here, maritime, the order must be created. And in November last year, that was a symbolic the time, the Prime Minister Noda, in the mid-November, went to Honolulu for APEC meeting. And there, about TPP, to join the consultation towards the joining the negotiation with the countries. And that was welcomed by the President Obama. And then in this year, in Bali, the summit talk was held. And Prime Minister Noda advocated the formation of maritime rule. And of course, there is no the hypothetical enemy in that scheme. And there are many territorial claims and disputes. And the China advocates bilateral the solution, but the international rulemaking is the best in order to bring about fair and open solution to any country. And so Prime Minister Noda advocated the maritime order, and ASEAN countries have been following that right now. And in April this year, the summit talks between Japan and United States, what Prime Minister Noda said, including shale gas in North America, in Asia-Pacific region. And Japan has a problem of nuclear the power, and energy cooperative the framework should be created in Asia Pacific, and so that is NODA doctrine, the three pillars. And when I was the assistant to NODA, and I made a preparation that he could make the foreign the policy speech, but so far he hasn't had that opportunity. And the current NODA, the cabinet, has come to an end, so it's quite unfortunate. But that is the background against which Mr. NODA act for his foreign policy. And so Japan-U.S. alliance, how we should deepen and evolve going forward. And ever since the start of the DPJ, the government, we have been advocating the deepening of Japan-U.S. alliance. In 2009, we acquired the power. And in 2010, this is the 50th anniversary of Japan-U.S. security alliance. In 2011, since signing of the Japan-U.S. security alliance, 60 years. And this year, 2012, ever since the security the arrangement going effective, this is the 60th anniversary. So we have had important milestones between Japan and U.S. Therefore, we have to constantly make efforts to deepen the relations. Of course, bureaucratically, sometimes there is the obstacle, but there is some the obstacle, a constraint that hampers the deepening. And I must be cautious in my remarks from here, but the close and the equal the relations between Japan and U.S., closer and the equal relations between Japan and U.S., that is within a manifesto. And in order to do so, the collective self-security, the self-defense right, is the core. And now is a time that political leaders must make efforts to discuss this more openly. This is not the bombing together with the United States in a third country. When there is attack on the U.S., under the current constitutional interpretation, we just stand still and do nothing. And I think with that stance, we are not able to maintain the sound alliance relations with the United States. That's what we have to put forth before the Japanese public. And the Japan-U.S. Security Treaty, the spectrum, in other words, total range, where the focus should be placed. And in 20-year span, that needs to be discussed between the two countries. Currently, Japan-U.S., the Security Treaty, the Article 5, the area under the control, if there is any attack, Japan and U.S. Will deal with that together. And NATO treaty, for instance, Europe and North America, that they will be covered. And the U.S. and Korea and the U.S. and the Philippines, U.S. and Australia. And so if you look at the alliance, the treaty in a Pacific the region, the joint action is taken under the collective security defense. And so Japan-U.S. The security treaty, not only the physically limited area, like under Japan's control, the Asia-Pacific area is vital region for Japan to the Japanese national interest. And therefore, for that particular region, the coverage should expand. I do not want to surprise the Professor Fu, but in long term, we should expand the range to cover the Asia-Pacific. And base issue, Okinawa issue, that has been the persistent issue, and concentration of the bases in Okinawa, we have to improve the situation to lighten the burden of Okinawa. And the bases, as a result of the Second World War, the U.S. occupied Japan and then they established the U.S. Bases. But that is within the territory of Japan. So how to return or how to use the U.S. forces or U.S. bases in Japan? An ideal way is if the U.S. the forces continue to stay, And that is quite preferable and important for the U.S. forces to continue to stay in Japan. And if that is so, the Japan should control that base and U.S. force should come into that base area for the operation. And there are many bases. And if that is just exclusively used by U.S. forces, that is not very healthy. So inclusive of that, as political leaders, we have to discuss this matter frankly, and we have to evolve the Japan-U.S. relations. And Professor Fu raised the issue about guideline. And in 1997, there was a revision of our defense guideline. And of course, there is a historical context since the end of the Second World War and Cold War. And in 1990, the Cold War was over. Japan-U.S. The alliance was really needed. And at that point, in order to answer that question, we redefine Japan-U.S. alliance. And the Japan-U.S. alliance should be the helpful to the regional stability, regional the peace. And the concrete the points were put together under the revised national defense guideline, and therefore the Chinese side should not be very nervous about the contents. And Professor Fu, as he explained, the Asia Pacific the picture from the perspective of Beijing, and also what Japan tries to evolve from now. Japan-U.S. The alliance. I think there is no much gap between those two ideas. So with this, I'd like to conclude. Thank you very much.
Thank you. He talked about the Noda Doctrine, but actually that's more like the Nagashima Doctrine. He explained in depth, and he can establish a new party People's security comes first party or whatever. So under the, now we'd like to ask Dr. Bader to speak. He was responsible for the Asian policy under the Obama administration. So Obama and China's Rise is his new book, 13 chapters in all, 2 chapters for Japan. Amongst books written by advisors to the U.S. president, no other book has given so many pages for Japan. So one chapter talks about the confusion under Hatoyama, and the other chapter about the Khan administration response to the 3/11. I don't know how deep he can talk about that, but Dr. Beda, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Sunhar-san, and thank you to Strobe and Richard Bush as well for bringing me to Tokyo on this occasion. It's, as a refugee from the Obama administration, it's wonderful to be in a country where, according to the polls on Obama versus Romney, the Japanese people chose Obama 87-12. It would have been a much shorter and easier night for us in the United States if those numbers were reflected as well in Strobe's state of Ohio. But I also note that despite what Richard Hu said about problems that China has with Obama administration policy towards China, that the same poll showed that Chinese citizens preferred President Obama to Romney by about 65-35. So it sounds like we weren't doing everything wrong. Great to be on the panel with my old friend Ichiro Fujisaki, who was a fantastic ambassador to Washington, Richard Hu, who's thoughts, as usual, I found insightful and provocative, and Aki Nakashima, who is widely respected in Washington as a real pillar of the relationship. And I wasn't aware till today, till you spoke just now, about your role on the East Asia community in shifting the Japanese position from the Hatoyama period to the Khan period, and for that. Those of us in the Obama administration are eternally grateful to you. I'll speak for a while about perceptions of Japan in the United States, and then I'd like to talk a little bit about the Japan-China relationship and what what can be done. First, attitudes in the U.S. towards Japan among the American elite, and I would say that is the right category because there simply is not as much attention to Japan among the population as a whole as there was a couple of decades ago. But among the elite, the attitude towards Japan is essentially nearly uniformly positive. The U.S.-Japan relationship and the U.S.-Japan alliance is not controversial. Sometimes you'd like to see more written about it. If something is written on the subject, it usually means it's a matter for debate. It is not really a matter for debate in the United States. Japan is seen as supporting the same objectives as the United States does in much of the world, in Iran, in North Korea. We had the closest of coordination when I was in the administration, on Libya, on Syria, on global issues such as nonproliferation, climate change, if we ever do what we should do in the United States. Japan is seen as a leader, a friend, and a reliable partner on all of these issues. Japan is seen as committed to the U.S.-Japan alliance after the unsettling period we had during the Hatoyama cabinet, about which Aki spoke a few minutes ago. Japan's own experiments in rebalancing, if you will, that ended happily from our perspective, but not without a certain amount of unease. Japan is seen as being very helpful, and I think Ichiro alluded to this, being extremely helpful and in some ways ahead of us in rebuilding a reformed and democratizing Myanmar, where I think Japan is going to have the lead, frankly, given what I've read about Japanese intentions there, and in building relations with India. But these are all positives, but I'd say that there are some elements that limit the effectiveness of Japan in foreign policy and that limit the effectiveness of the alliance. The first and obvious one, and I have nothing profound to say on the subject, you're all aware of it, that two decades of relative stagnation economically have made Japan a less powerful and less prominent player in the region and globally. Secondly, I'd say that a certain clumsiness and inability to deal with some of the legacy issues, and I'm sure some of you probably will tune out when I say this because you've been hearing this for decades, but some of the legacy issues from World War II profoundly affect relations with South Korea, affect relations with China, and to a lesser degree, affect relations with other countries in Southeast Asia. Issues we've had for the last few years, the most pro-Japan presidents in modern South Korean history. And we still ended up with him hopping on a helicopter and flying over to Takashima. One needs to ask, how did this happen? And it's clearly these legacy issues, things like comfort women, textbook issues, Yasukuni Shrine, which we've been over and over, but they give fodder for Japan's enemies and adversaries throughout the region, which they are happy to use. And I do not have the solution. I don't have a magic wand. I don't believe there's some clever formulation of apology beyond what has already been used is the answer. But it is something that you are going to have to figure out how to deal with. I mean, the fact of the matter is right now you have bad relations with South Korea, bad relations with China, and bad relations with Russia. These are your three principal neighbors, not to mention North Korea. That's a whole other matter. But unless you're just going to take the attitude of, well, these are problematic countries and there's nothing we can do about it, you've got to start figuring out what you are going to do about it. And as I look at that landscape, I would think that South Korea would be the easiest one to try to deal with. Now, I know how sensitive these issues are. The United States, we've had to deal with all sorts of legacy issues from our sometimes hideous mistakes in the past. treatment of African Americans, treatment of American Indians, treatment of Japanese during World War II in the camps. And we've come up with formulation, with variations, variations of compensation, apologies, congressional resolution, and a century and a half long effort to deal with the legacy of slavery with mixed results. But we have elected an African American president, which says something. But anyway, not specific ideas, but I think you've got to keep this in mind, as painful as it is. And third, the self-imposed limitations on international military activity in Japan. And Aki spoke about what Japan can and can't do, and I was very heartened by what he had to say about Japan's intentions. Certainly in talking to American policymakers, there was frustration about the limitations in Iraq, where it seemed that most of the efforts were designed at force protection of the Iraqi forces, of the Japanese forces in Iraq, rather than actually operating. And the limitations in Afghanistan, which you all recall, were essentially producing a refueling exercise in the Indian Ocean, which was terminated when Mr. Hatoyama took office. Let me talk for a few minutes about the Japan-China relationship. Just let me start by coming back to something Richard Hu said about how the U.S. needs to provide reassurance not only to Japan but to China. And I was glad to hear Richard allude to the trilateral process between U.S., Japan, and China. What I'd point out on that is, you know, we at Brookings took the lead in creating a track two process among those three countries. In my view, it was quite successful. We had four excellent meetings with very candid delegations from each country, and we achieved a good degree of consensus. And we did it at a hard time. It was after demonstrations in China against Japanese diplomatic and commercial establishments. At the end of it, the three delegations recommended, let's take this to track one. Let's the three governments agree that we should have conversations in track one among these three countries. What happened? China vetoed it, okay? So this was an attempt by the U.S. to do exactly what you're talking about, Richard. And the Chinese, frankly, in a rather casual and dismissive way, at a mid-level of the foreign ministry, said, nope, we're not going to do it. And to the extent that we ever got an explanation, the explanation seemed to be, we can't do something like this because the North Koreans will be unhappy. They will feel excluded, and they might misbehave. Well, they had just misbehaved pretty badly in the 2 months right before that. They had launched an intercontinental ballistic missile, and they had exploded a nuclear device. So I'm not sure exactly what good behavior China purchased by not proceeding that dialogue. In fact, what we saw in the next year was more bad behavior by the North Koreans. So I hope that Chinese officials will take to heart what you said. I think that is an important way of reassurance about U.S. intentions and Japanese intentions. There are other things I could say in response to what Richard said, but I don't want to use up all of our time. Japan and China have obviously had a deeply problematic relationship for almost 70 years since the war and the Japanese occupation of China. From the Chinese side, I think there's a mixture of historic grievance and humiliation, over the century of humiliation and Japan's role in it, combined with a pride in China's rise and a kind of breed of nationalism coming out of this that occasionally has an angry edge. The fetish over the unfulfilled nationalist agenda, which used to be focused overwhelmingly on Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Macau, has lately moved towards the South China Sea and towards the East China Sea, with more assertive positions by China on its territorial claims in those areas. China is not the only country with sort of rising and somewhat assertive nationalism in the East Asia area. We've seen disputes between South Korea and Japan take unpleasant turns because of nationalism, and I won't attempt to adjudicate whose nationalism was more assertive in this case, but it's certainly present on both sides. disputes in the South China Sea between China and the Philippines, between China and Vietnam, and, of course, the Japan-China dispute over the East China Sea. So this is a rising phenomenon throughout the region. Obviously, China is a somewhat special case because of its size, its trajectory, and the unique combination China presents of a country of development and underdevelopment, of a highly advanced civilization, and a political autocracy that is not particularly advanced. So how to manage the relationship between Japan and China and the U.S. peace in it? I think Japan can ill afford to have a hostile relations, as I say, with all three of its neighbors. And I would certainly counsel dealing with South Korea. The wartime legacy issues do need to be dealt with more forthrightly, although I have no illusion that doing so will magically or suddenly alter attitudes in Beijing or in Seoul, for that matter. I think the third point is that the alliance between the U.S. and Japan is vital for Japan's national security in the Asia we find itself now. I mean, Richard Hu talked about the steps since the alteration of the defense guidelines and the perception in China of the new directions in the U.S.-Japan security relationship. Well, this didn't occur in a vacuum, as Aki said. What's going on in the region for the last 15 years has been double-digit growth in China's military capabilities. One would have to be, blind, deaf, and dumb not to know that and not to react in some fashion to it. We can't just look from our own narrow national perspectives at developments and say everything is the fault of others. I think that Japan does need to look hard at its own security needs in the context of the alliance and also on its own. I think that Japan needs to do all it can to avoid gratuitous problems with China. The U.S. does not wish to see Japan and China at each other's throats. That was one of the reasons why we at Brookings created this trilateral process, why we wanted to take it to track one. I think that, personally, that the Japanese handling of the Sengoku issue left something to be desired. Let's just say that. If anyone wants to get more into it in questions and answers, I'd be happy to offer more opinions on it. But I think that the decision to buy the islands by the national government, in my view, was not inevitable. That said, I think that China needs to fundamentally alter its own perceptions and behavior towards Japan. The failure to recognize that Japan, after 70 years, is a fundamentally different country than one reads about, in Chinese propaganda, particularly since the Sengoku episode, where one is reading about fascism or return to fascism or a failure to learn the lessons of the anti-fascist war. This kind of, frankly, hysterical rhetoric that is disconnected from reality is not going to be the basis for any kind of reconciliation that the two countries need. I mean, I've always been of the view that sound analysis does not necessarily lead to sound policy. But I can assure you that wrong-headed and crazy analysis is going to lead pretty consistently to wrong-headed and crazy policy. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you indeed. Well, the ideally, we wouldn't have some time for questions and answers from the floor, but before we close off this panel discussion, within 16 seconds, and if you have any urgent comments you'd like to share among the panelists, please go ahead. Well, allow me to speak in English, because...
Who said U.S.-Japan relations... U.S.-Japan should respect security of regional countries in region. Countries... that was the Chinese spokesman's word, and maybe the other countries would say China should also respect the security of the countries of region. And I think Chinese would say, yes, we are doing it, but I don't think people are too much convinced about it. As for what the conflict women and things like that, we've been doing so many things in the last 15 years, but so I think we need to explain a little bit more. Third, I think the most important keyword here in dealing with China and Korea is decency. I think we should not go into quid pro quo and try to elevate emotion. If the other side is doing that, we should restrain ourselves. And I said in Japanese language school in Washington, D.C., that I chose my second foreign language as French, but if now I advised kids to learn Chinese or Korean and said, this island issue is what adults should be discussing. Don't discuss, you don't need to discuss it. You should make friends with kids of Chinese origin or Korean origin. That's my personal view. Thank you very much.
Dr. Fu, do you have anything?
Yes. I think Ambassador's comments and also Jeff's comment earlier about security concerns of other country, you know, U.S. Japan alliance did not happen in the vacuum, and it is response to something, especially you know, the rise of China, the China's rising military power. So that, you know, in some way justified the consolidation of the alliance. But I think a Chinese can make the similar argument. So here, this is my point. This is the security dilemma problem in East Asia. So everybody can finger point the other side. You are doing something, justify my defense spending. So we need to find a way to go beyond how to dampen the impact of the security dilemma. We need to borrow the lunch talk. We use the term awkward ideas or crazy ideas in East Asia to, you know, really move beyond the security dilemma that constrains us to build a healthy and a good relations.
Thank you. Nagashima-san, one phrase,
just one phrase, please. Mr. Nagashima. Well, Nabeira-san, well, they made reference to the Russia and China and also Japan. Actually, the relationship vis-a-vis these countries are becoming quite difficult. In the relationship with Russia, of course, we have northern territory issues, but all in all, I think we are actually going back to the good relationship, Siberia, and Saharan development, and again, and are playing a very important role in making the good relationship between Japan and Russia. As for the South Korean, of course, in you know, international, the Court of Justice, of course, was mentioned and over the territorial issues. But again, Japan and the South Korean actually do believe in separating the territorial issues as well as the political and economic issues. And here, the problem comes to the relationship with China, the Senkaku Island issue. Well, I would say, of course, this issue actually turned out to be a negative and impactful issues for both countries. Well, whether or not Japan is become nationalized, yes, we are receiving such a criticism to some extent. But well, there was an initiative by the Tokyo Metropolitan Government, and vis-a-vis that, we try to settle things down, manage things down in a rather calm fashion. I think so. Now we couldn't avoid that kind of process of activities. Well, nationalism actually, back in 1975, actually, it is the other side, who actually made a declaration. China actually made a declaration that, drawing a line, actually, this line inward, it is going to be a part of the Chinese territory. I think, this nationalistic movement actually got started, on the Chinese side. Again, going forward from now on, I think, both parties, both countries need to take a lot more a calmer attitude. Thank you indeed. Well, if I may, I'd like to thank all the people on the audience side and despite your busy schedules. My apologies and not being able to have question and answers, but again, please give them a big round of applause. Well, and thank you again on all the panelists. Would you please join me again and then give them a big round of applause and to send them off from the inner stage. Thank you indeed.
それではステージの準備が整いますまで。
If I'm not allowed to ask you to stay in your seat and we need to set up the stage moving into the last section now.
皆様、本日は日本経済研究センターブルッキングス研究所共催のシンポジウム北東アジアの変革。
So today, thank you very much for coming to the symposium, hosted by the Brookings Institute and Japan Center for Economic Research on Managing Transition in Northeast Asia, Global Economy and US-Japan Relations.Now, I would like to call upon Mr. Strobe Talbot, President of the Brookings Institutions, to give closing remarks.
This has been an absolutely terrific conference, and I speak on behalf, I hope, of all of you, but certainly on my, on behalf of my colleagues, from the Brookings Institution in expressing a couple of words of thanks and then just a very, very short, summary comment or two.First of all, we want to thank our partners, in the Japan Center for Economic Research and, of course, the leadership, Chairman Sugita and President Iwata. Also, of course, the participation of Nikkei and the Keizai Koho Center were indispensable to the success of the proceedings. And as for Go Sunohara, he is a master of multitasking.As I think all of you could see, both in what he was able to do at lunch, at the podium, and also behind the scenes and preparing for the program. And our thanks also to the staff of JCER, Nikkei, the Keizai Koho Center, and everybody else who contributed to this very good program. And that includes certainly the audible but mostly invisible interpreters.So thanks to all of you. The watchword of this conference has been transition. And I think it's in the spirit of a closing remark to strike a note of some hope about the future. And not just hope in the sense of prayer or wishful thinking, but hope that is based on the kind ofthoughtful analysis that we have heard from the speakers and presenters during the course of the day. So let me put the hope in these terms. What kind of transitions can we hope for as we make a transition on the calendar from the year of the dragon to the year of the snake, which is to say 2013?And I would suggest there are at least four things that we can hope for by way of transitions. One is an economic transition from an anemic recovery at the national, regional, and global level to a much more robust and sustainable recovery. Second, with regard to one very important country that we have heard from and talked about, and that's China,we can hope for a transition from a labor-intensive export economy to a high-value-added consumer society. Third, with regard to the regional and world trading system, we can hope for a more sophisticated pragmatic, and multi-speed WTO. And then finally, just a quick word about the relationship between politics and policy, which, of course, is not always a salutary relationship. And here I am picking up particularly on what we have heard from the two Richards, Richard Bush and Richard Hu. We can hope for a transition in four countries, Japan, Korea, China, and the United States, a transition from a year-long, if not longer, preoccupation with the domestic politics of succession, which is not always conducive to forward-looking foreign policy on the part of those countries, to an embrace of all four countries' obligation and opportunity for constructive diplomacy, maximizing common interests, and prudent management of sources of tension. In other words, a transition from excessive nationalism to enlightened, self-interested internationalism. So let's all hope for that. And thank you again for being here and for participating.
Talbot 所長、ありがとうございました。
Mr. Talbot, thank you very much for your remarks. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us for a long time over the day. With this, we'd like to conclude the symposium. Managing transitions in Northeast Asia, the global economy, and the U.S.-Japan relations. And about today's symposium, on the Nikkei, tomorrow's morning paper, and also on the 4th of December in a morning paper, there is a feature article. So thank you again. Thank you very much. And the receiver for the interpreting service, that is collected at the reception. So please make sure that you return the receiver. And the questionnaire that please fill out, and we'd like to collect your questionnaire back to our reception desk. Thank you very much for your participation. With this, we'd like to conclude. Thank you.